So basically, what I want to talk today is, since the subject of today is in fact the interoperability and security aspects of the Azure platform, I took liberty to constrain myself a bit to this because, yeah, we already had some application set up that goes to the different storage aspects, tables and so on, but this is clearly not the the idea. I will show it briefly what we've done and how we interacted with the FedIct. It was one of the questions over here. but this session will more elaborate on the interoperability and security aspects of the cloud. Okay. So what will we cover today is the service bus, what you can do with it. Different scenarios that are provided out of the box right now. And this mainly concerns the interoperability part. Secondly, the claims-based approach, model, architectures is really key in a cloud approach. And that's why I have a bigger part that will focus more on that that element. In the cloud, we have ACS, like it's already mentioned. Maybe if you drink a bit. So this will in fact foresee that you can separate the security part from your applications. So it's always a problem, okay, if you start creating applications, especially towards the cloud, how do I implement security? And security is really key once you broaden your scope to the internet. And I will explain how ACS can help you with that. Furthermore, for those of you who really don't get it with the claims-based identity, what are really claims? What are good claims? I will elaborate on that a bit. Furthermore, federation across realms. If you have your own applications that are available, you have partners that want to connect to your applications, what do you need to do regarding security? Do you need to embed or create temporary accounts for your partners or for temporary employees that are working? Well, with federation, you can tackle that as well. And then I will show you how you can use WIF, Windows Identity Foundation or framework, how you can interact with the FedIct. I'll show a demo of that. And lastly, I will show how you can use ACS to provide a single sign-on approach. Recently, in the Azure platform, which is always evolving, of course, is updated. So if you go to the internet and to your platform, you will see white over here, Windows. Yeah, that's fine. If you need to demonstrate something in the cloud and the internet connection is not up, okay, nevertheless, I have everything recorded, so no problem. You will see that the portal, in fact, is completely updated. They provide other options like caching and so on, and it becomes really more interesting to create applications in that. Let's proceed. Interoperability. Interoperability, well, everyone already knows how the cloud is structured. We have the web roles, the work roles. Web roles exposed or are hosted on IIS. It's mainly web applications that you want to expose or WCF applications that you want to expose in the cloud, public. You have one external HTTP endpoint and one external HTTPS endpoint at your disposal, and these are completely load balanced. You can use .NET 4.0 for that, and other, Bart already mentioned that, you can use other technology stacks as well. But just to give a brief example, you have the web role, you have your application, and what is really important in the cloud model is that you will use an asynchronous working model. So your application is exposed, people can order books, for example, or perform actions. And once that's informed in your web application, you typically have worker roles that we need to do the real work behind that. And that's the asynchronous part. What we have in some applications is that they create a web application, and within the same call, to a button click, for example, they start processing everything. That's creating all the ID over here. And in Azure, we really have a proper separation. If you have work to do, put it in work roles, and then you can split between the load, of course, and increase the scalability of your application. So work roles are not hosted in AIS, but you can have web services in that. They are self-hosted, okay? Up to five external, five load balanced endpoints. After all, you can create your own as well, but they're not load balanced then. And you can have interoperability communication between both. So from the web role, you can send information to a work role by means of WebCF. So typically, an example, we have the internet, we have some web roles, which host the actual application. You can dimension it like you want. Five small, for example, we duplicate it to have a high availability. Like I mentioned, if you have work to do, we can increase the size of our instances and opt for three large machines, for example, that really need to perform the actual work. We can have an admin, which shouldn't be high available, so one single instance can be sufficient. And we have some other work roles that are publicly exposed. And note that internally, you can have the connections as well. Okay. So what I want to discuss right now, how can we communicate between all those roles, which sit in a separate VLAN. So every deployment that is done from you, from as a company, sits within its own VLAN. So you can't influence other applications or call them directly if you don't pass via the service bus. And that's what I want to discuss right now. So the service bus, what does it actually do? Well, it's an ESB, an enterprise service bus. Probably a lot of you already know the ESB pattern. But NSS, in essence, what it provides you is a way of interconnecting different services. Different services, what we have right now is within enterprises. What the service bus provides to you is that it extends it towards the cloud, towards the internet, okay? And all the difficulties that coming with the deployment and the intercommunication via the internet are in fact covered by the service bus. So service bus will also connect heterogeneous applications that talk different protocols, that exchange a bit different messages. It is able to transform them, also different identities. It is able to transform them if you want. You can configure this. I will show you later on how it's done. The service naming is also important. There's a common service naming aspect in that. So every application that's exposed via the service bus resides over there, on service bus Windows.net, and it has its own service namespace. So if you create an application in the cloud, the first thing you need to do is enter a service namespace for your services. And this sits always in front of this URL. And then you can start dividing your application in multiple parts. But they're always well known. So you can have, for example, first of all, the countries, as name one, Belgium, France, etc. And after this, this can be simple to understand. But after this URL, it will be redirected to another different server, in fact. So you can group in a logical way your applications, but what's sitting behind can be totally distributed and installed on other networks. Okay, scheme can be HTTP or TCP. And this is really important to know towards the discovery part as well, discovery service registry. So once you install an application in the cloud, you can use Atom, the Atom protocol, to look up how many instances that are running actually. And then you can say, okay, give me your address, and then you can start talking to them. So this is also an important part that services are really discoverable. Federated identity mechanism, of course, since maybe using the cloud, and security is typically remaining on-premise in Active Directories, for example. You want to continue to use that same security model that you have installed. You don't want to copy this into the cloud again. And for that, you can have a connection via ADFS, Active Directory Federated Services. Broker of message formats, like I mentioned before, identity management and communication protocols. So applications that on first sight are not really compatible with each other can be connected if we opt for the service bus. Okay. So it acts as a DMZ as well. So traffic, if you expose your service to the net, it becomes a platform potentially for hackers. It can start denial of service attacks. The service bus acts as a first buffer for this kind of anomalies. An important aspect as well, if you have applications that are running on-premise, they're typically blocked by firewalls. We have the network address translation problems, let's say, if you want to expose them directly to the cloud. How can we reach applications that are sitting behind those systems? Well, there are nifty protocols in place so that, after all, you can start connecting to them as well. Come back to that later on. Another aspect as well is that you're not limited to the applications that you have provided yourself. You can have clear communication between applications of different companies. As long as you have a contract, as long as you can trust on the level of security the users that are working with those applications, you can really have a clear communication between multi-tenant applications. Okay, so which are the typical usage patterns on the level of connectivity? Like I mentioned, the service remoting. So if you have multiple services of one or multiple enterprises, we can start and let communicate those together. We also have a pattern like cloud eventing, so which is more publish-subscribe pattern. There's one application that wants to notify other applications or other instances, a chat application, for example, or a more complex application, of course. Well, the first one sends out a message. The service bus will automatically distribute it to the listeners. Okay. Protocol tunneling is also something that's foreseen. And there, for example, the SQL Server that's in the cloud, it used the name pipes. Well, it can pass via a protocol tunnel and hence have a communication with on-premise SQLs as well. Okay. Second part is messaging, patterns for building scalable applications. The load leveling, of course. If you have message flows between components with different send receive rates, first can send out a message, the second is maybe not so responsive as you would like. Well, you can have multiple listeners, you can install multiple instances, and then find an equivalent between the rate of sending the messages and the rate that the messages are processed. Loosely connected clients as well, this is also supported. So the service bus foresees in message buffering, whereby an application creates a buffer in the cloud, in the service bus, and then clients can send out messages and the listener needs to start polling for those messages. So if one of the systems goes out, the queue is not really deleted or the message buffer is not really deleted, it can poll later on and hence have a message exchange between applications that once a while disconnect. So what are the different scenarios that we have? Well, people that already have worked or developed web services in .NET, WCF is the most common way of realizing those applications. And we have different kind of bindings, the basic HTTP, web, etc. So these are the ones that people regularly use on-premise if they want to create applications. But Microsoft has really extended this towards the cloud. And you see that for each protocol that is used by people nowadays on-premise, they have an equivalent cloud base. So you have seen in the previous picture where we have two applications and the mediator of the service bus between them, while the relay is added to those protocols, and this opens a world for different kind of scenarios. First one is the Net1 relay binding, and basically what the protocol will do, of the way of working that we need to follow over here, is that a client and a service who needs to talk to each other, first of all, needs to open connection to the service bus. They enter on the service bus, and here are the different endpoints. And this is a network load balancer. So you come in, the service bus is aware at that moment that there's a client and there's a service. And if you use the Net1 way relay binding, this is one that's used only to send out messages. So fire and forget. You have the client sends out message to a service. It really doesn't expect a response. Never mind. A bunch of scenarios that you can imagine for having that. Important part over here is that, yeah, if this service is residing within your premise, if you have your firewall, you have your nets in place, and you know that, for example, in a firewall, it typically allows only outbound calls to be performed. We'll let that go through. If the client wants to send in a message on a different port, this typically is blocked in your firewall. Okay, unless it's regarded as a response on a message. And that's in fact what we have over here. Since this one registers itself on the service bus, there's already a connection, and then the service bus can route that message to the open endpoint and hence find the service over here. Okay. So suppose you have your firewalls really tied down. You say, okay, I'm really in a strict environment. They only permit a communication on HTTP and SSL lines. Well, even then, you can configure that this one won't use TCP as a communication protocol, but stick to the default HTTP as well. So even in strict environments, where there's a lot of security in place, where they block every access, even there, as long as the HTTP and SSL is working, you can have communications in place. Okay, so you can opt to encrypt your messages that are sent over the bus, because over here we see SSL, over there we see SSL, so we have a private path to the service bus. But once this enters over here, since it needs to route it to another part, it will remove the signing of your message, in fact, so that everything can travel as well. So if you say, okay, the designing, I find it is important, or the SSL I find it is important, and the message is really private from nature, you can help to encrypt it as an extra. Okay. Net event relay binding. Well, here, like I mentioned before, you can have the publish subscriber. So this one will publish an event, and you can have one or multiple listeners that are interested in receiving that message. The idea is the same, so they register themselves on the cloud, and then when the first one sends out the message, the cloud is aware that there are one or multiple listeners. It's comparable to UDP, but underneath it still uses TCP, which is more reliable. And it's in fact the cloud that calls them quite in parallel, the different listeners. It's comparable, but not entirely to UDP, of course. Okay. Now, TCP relay binding. The first one was one-way communication. Okay. The eventing was the second one. Over here, we want to have two-way messaging over TCP. The difference over here is that we want to have a bidirectional communication channel. And therefore, the service bus will know, okay, these two wants to communicate together. It will bring the connections together in a socket-socket forwarder. And you have two models, in fact. You can opt for the relay mode, or you can opt for the hybrid mode. In the relay mode, every traffic or all traffic always passes through the service bus. It uses the socket forwarder over here. But there's no problem over there because you always have the mediator to send the messages. So even with the lockdown firewalls. In the hybrid mode, this one is a bit different. So it starts in the same model, both register themselves on the service bus. But then later on, since you have indicated in your binding that you want to use the hybrid model, it will try to connect directly to, or the client will try to connect directly to the service. So in doing that, again, outbound messaging is permitted on a firewall, inbound is not permitted, but the service bus knows that this one has registered himself, this one has registered himself as well. So if this one wants to start the communication, it sends a message with some information. I'm sitting on this IP address and I'm using this port. Okay, this travels over here. The service bus tries to connect to this one and sends that control message to here. Then the service will try to call the client directly with the information that it has received from the service bus. But this will be blocked in the firewall because this the firewall or the router doesn't know exactly. It's not the router that I need to say, of course. It's a router that doesn't know directly the channel towards your client. But since this one started an outbound call, the routing tables over here already know if messages are coming from this client, he will know how to route in to this this service. So this one has a routing map already in place. When messages from this one go to there, that it is really routed to the service. Okay. Then the client will perform the same thing. And then both connections will be set up in both routes from client and server. And then they will quit the service bus and really perform a direct communication. This is in effect based on sort of guessing of which port the router will use when you start communicating, because if you have an application that sends out a message, let's say it's on port 10,000, once it traverses the router, the public port number can be different. And the public port number that the router uses is in fact brand dependent. So they can use the same port number, they can use a port number added with 10,000, for example. And this is in fact the intelligence that's in place in the service bus to know, okay, I'll first try the same port number, I will use another port number, and it needs to send some messages before it finds a direct channel, before it finds a response, a responsive channel. And once this succeeds, then we will have the direct communication. It can happen that it doesn't work, and then it just continues working like in the relay mode. Okay. So, a very small example of NetTCP relay binding, so the hybrid model. doing some work. So what I've done over here, I have two servers and a client. We have the hybrid binding configured. It's just plain web service that we create, but relate. We start the client and the service. And what we'll see is that the client will traverse through the service bus. So there's no direct connection between both, of course. Although I need to run them on the same machine over here, but this one, the client can be over here, the service can wherever it will be. And over here we see that we had the initial communication via the service bus. They tried to communicate directly, and suddenly it succeeded. And we saw that the throughput increased, and that we not built anymore because the communication is directly there. So can be an important aspect as well. Okay. Next, we have the HTTP relay binding. Just for now, we saw the TCP. If you have applications that are non-VCF based client applications, then you can stick with the HTTP relay binding. And typically, we can have services that expose themselves as the REST services. Then you can use the HTTP relay binding, web HTTP relay binding, in fact. If you have the default web services that you want to expose, you can use the basic HTTP relay binding. Or if you want to have extra DBS protocols in place, you can use the WS 2007 HTTP relay binding. So these are, in fact, comparable with the equivalents we know and the default WCF. Message buffer, already explained. So the service connects itself, the server connects itself to the service bus. This one wants to send out a message. It can do it, and then the consumer will poll for it. If the consumer stops polling at a certain moment, the slot will disappear automatically. So it's important that you keep polling to maintain that message buffer. Messages are stored in memory, so it's not an equivalent of a robust robust system like a queue, which can be persisted as well. Because if one of those resilient servers goes down, messages that are stored in memory on that machine in the cloud will disappear. Okay, so keep aware of that. It's an interesting mechanism for disconnected systems, but if you really need to have a robust, persistent medium, you should stick to the queuing mechanism. Okay. Next, so the interconnectivity was first thing, security. So security, claims-based identity, practical scenario. Well, we all know the airport. And if I go to the airport, I need, first of all, to prove who I am if I want to take a flight. So in order to do that, I take my, in Belgium, I need to present my identity card. If I want to have a domestic flight, my domestic would be difficult in Belgium, but let's say Spain. I think this between Brussels and Liège connection, but nevertheless. So I need to prove myself, and that's based with an ID that's rather localized. In Belgium, I need to use my Belgian ID card. In America, I can use my driver license, for example. So this is not a uniform way of identifying yourself. Secondly, I go to the service desk, or to the desk, where I do this. And the woman behind the desk, she really verifies, she trusts, if I present the Belgian ID card, that this is a valid one. And only then I will receive my boarding pass. And a boarding pass is a bit different, because this becomes your medium to claim your flight, to claim your seat on a flight. It only contains information that's important within the airport. So it doesn't contain your age, because no one within the airport, if you go, need to travel the border, for example, or the customs, or take a flight, no one wants to know your age. So it's simply not put on that. Okay? What is put on that is the gate. What is put on that is your seat, of course. And if you have flight to take and you need to land in with a stop and travel further, you can continue to use those documents that you have received because they are trusted in the whole world, let's say, when you're traveling. Okay? So you present the same information to the customs when you check, when you want to gate, and then you take your flight. So the boarding pass is in fact your security token, which contains a number of claims, and that's how you should regard it when you want to transform this to IT. So there are a number of specific elements if you regard to claims-based identity. First of all, we have the relying party, or the service provider, it's all the same. And the relying party is simply the application that wants to use the claims. Okay. There are two models. We have the active clients and the passive clients. Active clients, the rich clients, smart and the smart clients, let's say. And these will rely on WS Trust and WS Federation Active Requester Profile. And they will first access the identity provider or the security token service. They will retrieve a token, and then, since they're stateful, they have a state, that's a Windows application, for example, or WPF application. Once it receives a token, then it can make out calls to services and pass in that token. Okay? Passive clients, like web applications, can't really do that because, like Bart mentioned, they're not stateless, they're not stateful, but rather stateless. And they need to rely more on HTTP protocols, GET and POST operations, redirections that are performed in order to have this claim-based identity in place. Subject or principal is also an important element. It's in fact the user that's using your application. So if we're talking about the principal, well, it's simply the user of the application. And lastly, we have the issuer. We have three types, but need to say that they're often used together. First of all, we have the security token service, which will in fact issue the token or the security token with the claims embedded in it. Okay? So this is the first thing. Secondly, we have the identity provider, and this one will give you a token based on your user credentials. So it will validate your user credentials. You can look at this more like the woman at the service desk in the beginning. Okay? So she looks at your Belgian your ID card, and then she gives you the boarding pass. And lastly, we have a resource security token service. So this will typically transform tokens that are presented from an IDP and transform them in claims that are more application-oriented. Okay. Often these roles are combined in a single one. But you can have models, which I will show you later on, that are split. Okay. So how does it work for passive clients? We have a client machine with a user on it. We have the application which want to use claim-based identification. And what we do is, first of all, we create a trust with a security token service. Because once we will receive a token later on, if there's no a trust with the one FedEx, for example, or your ADFS, if there's no trust, the token that you will receive can be validated if it's genuine, if you don't trust it. Okay? So I will show you in the Fed example what this really means if you use WIF. We will create a trust. So the first thing that what we will do is consulting the public service, public web service of the security token service. We will retrieve an XML document, and we will add a lot of things in a configuration so that this trust can be set in place. Secondly, when the client calls, I want to call an page of your application. You can compare this to form-based authentication. It will be automatically redirected to the service token service. Okay? And it will present a number of interesting things that the security token service can interpret. Okay? Identity information, for example. If this is accepted by the security token service, it will consult eventually, for example, if you use ADFS, it will, I don't see it with the arrow. So if this one is ADFS, it will connect to AD, for example, can even connect to SQL or LDAP to retrieve some information that is important for your application. And then all that information will be returned in a security token, like we see over here, to the client machine. And once this is in place, redirection will be performed again. And the token will be sent along with it. And once the application receives a token, it has everything in place since we had the trust. It can validate if the token that is sent is signed properly, is from the right security token service. And then it can proceed, of course. It will install a cookie. And if you continue to use your application, this process doesn't need to be performed anymore. Okay. So here we have an example where we use WIF to add a claim-based security. So what I've done is just created an out-of-the-box web application. I didn't show, of course, but just new application. It's a default MVC application, like you see over here. Nothing fancy. So what I want to do right now is relying on Windows Identity Foundation. I need to install it. It's free of charge. You can download it, install it in your environment. And then you will see that a number of options come available. So out of the box, what we have is form-based authentication in this application. We have the role provider and all that kind of stuff. It's not really important, but yeah, it's registered, of course, this thing. Over here, like I mentioned, you have the two options that become available. And now we will use it, so add STS reference. And what we're doing over here is, in fact, creating the trust through your STS. Okay, this will be embedded in the web config, in the configuration file of your application. What we need to do then is specify the application URI that needed to be protected, or needed to be made claims aware. From now on, since I installed it locally, I just specify localhost, but later on, if you deploy to the cloud, you can change your web config so that it points correctly. And this information will be, in fact, used later on to validate if the token that is received is really meant for your application. Next, we will specify the security token service. We can create one of ourselves, or we can use the one that's provided by FedEct. So we just need to contact their web service. I need to say this is still in development. So it's a test environment. They're planning to release it quite soon to have it in RTM, let's say. But you can already use this. In that document, you saw that there were a number of claims defined. So your application will know, by means of that XML file, which claims that will be exposed. We can opt for the certificate chain validation if you have a VeriSign certificate in place. I just leave it like it is right now. You can use the encryption like I mentioned before. If the message that is sent is really important to be protected, you can select a certificate to encrypt that information as well that's sent over the wire. I just leave this as well since it's a demo. And here it just examined the XML that was received from FedEx. And we see what's exposed by the FedEx service. Okay. Then I'll accept it. It's added. And it changed our configuration file. Won't go too much in detail, but what we have in place is a number of models that are injected automatically by the WIF framework, which will really do the routing for you, so you don't need to do anything special for that. We're responsible for validating incoming tokens, which will, need to foresee some power over here. Pardon for that. Yeah, and this one is running, so need to be quick. But in essence, what we see is are the claims that are injected in our application. We can say I'm interested in knowing them all. So you can configure this in your application. And if you launch it, so basically I didn't need to do a lot. There's a lot behind the scenes, of course. But WIF really makes it quite transparent. So we start up the application. I see by means of the HTTP module that we are automatically redirected to the FedEx service where I need to enter my card. I have a card reader in a machine. So yesterday I injected my Belgian EID. He detects it. I enter my PIN number. It says, OK, you're fine. The information that you sent to me by means of that card reader is okay. And you enter over here in your application, you see automatically that it was in fact my ID that was used and all the claims that are coming in. And based on those claims, you can really protect your application or do specific work out of the box. Okay. So this all works as well in the cloud, of course. The same principles, you have the claims-based authentication. I just created it over here, but our service works as well in the cloud, and there you can rely on that as well. Okay. All right. Where are we? Next, the Azure Access Console service. What we've seen right now is that we relied on an SDS on-premise, but the SDS can be within your premise, the ADFS, for example, which will route to your AD. This one can be exposed as well to the cloud. But the ACS acts as an SDS as well, and this one is really sitting in the cloud. So what we have with that one is cross-platform support. So whichever application that is capable of using HTTPS can in fact rely on ACS to use the claim-based authentication. There's an ADFS V2 integration, and that I can't really show you on this machine, but you can install ADFS on your machine, embed it in the ACS, and then rely on the information that is sent from the ID to protect your application. Okay. The simplest way to protect your application is, in fact, relying on the lightweight authentication that you see in a lot of demos, where you just need to enter an issuer name and a shared secret. So it's a hash code. You receive this when you create a service bus connection. And the portal, you just have those two fields. When you create a connection to your application, you only need to specify that username hash or issue name hash or shared hash. And then this can be interpreted as well for the security. Furthermore, we have support for web resource authorization protocol and a simple web token. This is a bit more complex, but you can receive, like I mentioned before, in the smart environments, where you first call a token and you use that token to communicate later on, to pass a token and enhance user application. Okay. And rule mapping is something that's really improved right now. I have a demo at the end that will show how you can do this. So the one I was referring to is in fact the Access Control Service, V2. So this one integrates with Windows Identity and the tooling. There's out-of-box support right now, because we already mentioned a couple of times that Google and Live ID and Yahoo can be used. Well, with this version, you really can use it today. You can also hook in your ADFS out of the box right now. Okay, so the different protocols that are used, open authorization protocol 2.0, trust and federation, which was already in place before. But they simply extended, and it's really nice thing to see. Okay, the portal. Yeah, I go through that straight away. So basically what we will have with the ACS is in fact, and if we opt for the Google approach, for example, we just want to enter our Gmail account or our Live ID account, that's working equally fine. In that scenario, we will really split the identity provider and the SDS, the resource SDS. So we'll do two different machines. First of all, we will connect, if we have indicated that we want to use a social network credential, it will contact the service in place, Google, Facebook, whatever. It will receive their token, and that token will be passed to the resource SDS, which is in that case the ACS V2. It will be interpreted correctly, and then you can start using your application. There's already trust in place between the SDS and the identity provider of the different social networks. Or your ADVS, you can configure this as well. And then you can start using that. So, how does it work? Well, more or less the same. You have an identity provider call. Then, once this token is received, we will call the resource SDS. This one understands the token of the identity provider, and then it sends back a token specific for an application, and that one is then sent to the application, and it contains all the claims that are important to use. Okay. So let me show you the demo. So over here you see the appfabriclabs.com environment. I've created, in the project that I have, I want to create a new service. Let's call it this one. I create this one, and it takes a couple of seconds to be created. And this is, in fact, it is a newer version, so you see the service bus and the caching support as well. So from now, you can easily configure the caching over here. But the access control is really improved. And once this one is completed, you can continue. So in the past, this was really not that easy to use. You had a tool that's really downloadable, ACM browser, for example. But this one didn't offer all the functionality that you have over here. So basically, what we will do is start up with an identity provider. Since we will using this one as an SDS, we need to have an identity provider. We will also need to define our applications. Okay, we will need to define the rules that we want to have in place. Which kind of claim do we want to expose? If that claim comes in, will we accept or reject the call? This can all be configured over here. So here we started with the identity provider. To define. So we have two in place right now. We return, and then we can continue in defining our application within ACS. Okay, so what we will do over here is just say, okay, I'm busy creating this application. We just give it a name, and Realm is quite important because this one will be used in the signing aspect and knowing that when a calls come in from a specific application, it will act as a key within ACS mm-hmm. to know, okay, which are the rules that need to be checked later on. We can opt for this application which identity provider we want to use. I want just to create a new set of rules. Okay, so let's proceed. We have our application defined. We have our identity provider in place. And now we need to set up some security. Default rule group is the one specific for our application that we want to define. And there you have a number of options. You just can say, okay, generate all the rules that are coming from that provider out of the box. So there are a number of claims that are exposed. And by default, if you click on that as a shortcut, let's say, it will just create a pass-through of all those claims that are coming from the identity provider. A pass-through is just that the name is known. It creates another name on the other side and passes the value transparently. Okay. So you can add custom rules as well, delete rules. So this is fully configurable within the cloud. Then, if you have set this in place, we can look at the federation metadata over here. And this is in fact comparable with what I've done with the FedEct approach. I just indicated to the FedEct equivalent the XML that I want to use. Now I'm relying on ACS, so I'm using the ACS equivalent of my application. And I will just add the same thing in our application again. So add STS reference, point to my application. So over here you see that this matches the Realm, what I've defined. I just specify the XML file that's retrieved dynamically. I click on Finish. Okay. So over here, audience URIs. This is the one that's in fact used to validate if a token comes in that's not a faulty token that's meant for application. This is in fact the key that will be used to verify this on client side as well. So now I start up the application, and out of the box, this can be fully customized as well. You can upload another login screen, but I only configure those two. So if I want to use Google, first time I want to use it, Google asks, okay, do you want to permit this that an application consult this information? It's just IDP custom code, let's say. And here in our application, we see, okay, that this is in fact information that's coming in from the claims that are embedded in the security token. Okay. So next, what I was busy preparing, in fact, was the ADFS connectivity. I missed some routing within my private environment, I can't really show you from here because we am in another environment, of course. The direct connectivity, that was the idea to show you that I can use the same approach instead of opting for Google, opting for ADFS, and then really consult an AD that's running in a virtual machine on my laptop. But this I unfortunately can't show over here.